Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Merkel Media.
Good, everybody. This is Joel Thomas from Free the Rabbits. And how are all the free range rabbits doing out there today? I want to say thank you to everyone who has been going to Spotify and going to Apple Podcasts and hitting the follow button in addition to listening to the show. It's such a small thing to do, but it helps the show grow immensely. So for that, I want to say thank you. And if you haven't hit the follow button on Spotify or Apple, make sure you do that now. Also, if you've been a follower of the show and you haven't given it a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, go do that now. And if you're on Apple, make sure you write a great review as well to go along with the 5 stars. That is another way to help the show grow and get deeper into the algorithm, which allows it to get to even more people. If you're new to the show, take a listen, and if you enjoy it, go give it a 5-star review immediately afterwards. We have just recently started Free the Rabbits merchandise with our Touchgrass shirts, rabbit logo tees and hats, Nephilim Portal Baby tees, and our new Puck Wudgie Tube shirts available in all sizes with several color options. Also, for the people who have been asking how they can donate to the show financially, we have several ways to do so. You can go to buymeacoffee.com/freetherabbits, where we have monthly memberships, or you can give a one-time donation. If you are following on YouTube, we also have memberships there with different tiers, all of which have custom emojis you can use while on the channel. And if you can't donate financially, just you donating your time is the best gift possible to the show. And for that, thank you so much. Keep sharing the show, everyone. Now, let's get into it. What is up, guys? We are back for the final episode, part 4. Of the occult origins of the Men in Black. Last week, we went really into depth with Carl von Eckerthausen's book, The Cloud Upon the Sanctuary. And this is where the idea of the secret chiefs really come from. And that trickled into the Golden Dawn, Theosophy, and many other secret societies. But this is where that particular idea comes from. Now, today, we're going to get into 2 different things. We're going to get into some ciphers, and we're going to talk specifically about a cipher that's connected to the origins of the Golden Dawn, and it will connect directly into a secret chief. And we will also talk about the secret cipher of the UFO knots from Alan Greenfield, and he talks about his cipher that he's worked on and what that connects to when we're talking about the secret chiefs, i.e. the Men in Black, because this is what we're roping this all back around to, is the idea of who the Men in Black actually are on an occult level, right? And I'm going to preface this again. I've been saying this throughout all of these episodes, that the Men in Black, I don't believe, are one particular thing. However, I think they all work for very similar organizations, maybe under one umbrella of the same governing body. And we can say that governing body is supernatural at the very top, right? But we're talking in this series specifically about these Men in Black that have supernatural abilities that seem to be more than human. However, we have been talking about the secret chiefs are a very interesting group, these Mahatmas, these ascended masters. They're not just supernatural beings. They are humans who have been elevated, as well as extraterrestrial beings that are supposedly from off-world, which I would probably rope more into the supernatural being umbrella, if we're going to look at it that way. But we are going to get into some of the cipher knowledge today. We're going to get deeper into some of the Men in Black occult stories that people have had, the interactions they've had with these ascended masters, these secret chiefs that come off very similar to the modern day Men in Black. Now, to get to this first cipher, because this is going to give us an idea how ciphers work, because I want to talk about the specific cipher that started the Golden Dawn before we get into what Alan Greenfield has been working on for years and years and years that he discovered back in the 1990s. So we're going to look at these manuscripts called the Cipher Manuscripts, and they were the foundational documents of the original Order of the Golden Dawn, and they were written in English using the Trithemius cipher. And the Trithemius cipher was written by Johann Trithemius in his book Polygraphia, and it was actually the first published print work, cryptology. And Trithemius was a German Benedictine abbot and polymath, and he was active during the German Renaissance. And the way that this particular cipher works, it uses a letter square with 26 letters of the alphabet, followed by 26 rows of additional letters. And each is shifted once to the left from the one above it. And it creates 26 different ciphers out of that. And the result, the cipher text appears as a random string or block of data. And because of the shifting of the variables by doing this, the natural letter frequencies are hidden. But if the codebreaker obviously knows how it's supposed to shift, they can crack the code. So this is important because this also goes back to what I talked about during the Agent Crowley series about MK Ultra. And I talked about the hidden blinds that he used to hide within his writings and how these words would mean different things. Very similar in the way that a lot of these occult manuscripts will have triple meanings depending on if you know what the cipher is and how to operate the cipher. And in this particular cipher manuscripts that started the Golden Dawn, they gave specific outlines of the grade rituals of the order, and they actually prescribed, they created curriculum and these graduated teachings, because remember, in the Golden Dawn, you've got three levels, and once you achieve that third level, you can become a secret chief. Very similar to what Crowley was doing with the OTO and the AA. And these graduated teachings, they encompass the Hermetic Kabbalah, astrology, occult tarot, geomancy, and alchemy. So everything an occultist would want, but this is what these cipher manuscripts did. Now, how they were even found was very interesting. In 1886, they were allegedly, and I'm going to explain further why they were allegedly, they were passed on to Freemason William Wynne Westcott, and then he decoded them a year later. If you know anything about William Wynne Westcott, he was one of the founders of the Golden Dawn, and I've talked about him before, specifically in his connections with Crowley. So when Westcott cracks the code of the cipher, he initially goes to Samuel Adel Mathers, also another founder of the Golden Dawn, and he asks his help to break down these manuscripts. And obviously, he decides to help. And then they create the rituals of the Golden Dawn out of these manuscripts. So to go a little further into the cipher manuscripts, they're a collection of 60 folios. And folios are individual leaf paper or parchments. And they're written on the front side only. And generally, they're not bound. They're going to be loose leaf, but they'll be compiled together to create a manuscript, right? And these collection, the cipher manuscripts, contain the structural outline of a series of magical initiation rituals corresponding to the spiritual elements of earth, air, water, and fire. And I thought that was interesting because I'm a huge fan of the anime Avatar. And in Avatar, those are the four elements, and certain people have access to be able to bend the elements at will. You know, you've got your airbenders, your waterbenders, your firebenders, your earthbenders. And I find it interesting in a lot of anime that a lot of occult imagery and just magic with a CK is implemented all through it. It's fascinating to me. So these cipher manuscripts are arranged in a syllabus of graded course of instruction in magical symbolism. And it's used as the structure for the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And this was after those manuscripts came through William Westcott. And how William Westcott even came to get them, they were through Adolphus Frederick Alexander Woodford. And he was the son of Alexander George Woodford. And George Woodford was a career soldier, and he was a hero at Waterloo. His son also joined the army as well. But when he got out of the army, he became a Freemason, and he became Grand Chaplain in 1863 over the lodge that he was a part of. What's also interesting, he became a scholar of Masonic history. And towards his death, at the end of 1887, he passed on a set of coded papers, which resulted in the establishment of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. So he was friends with William Westcott. He gave him these papers and said they were very important. So originally, William Westcott was a part of the SRIA, and you'll see that acronym come up a lot. It stands for Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, and it's a Rosicrucian esoteric order, and it's not connected directly to the Masons, but it does have ranks very similar to Freemason lodges, specifically in England. And author Edward Waite was also a part of this as well. We talked a lot about him last episode when we were talking about The Cloud Upon the Sanctuary. So what ties these manuscripts, not only in starting the Order of the Golden Dawn, but it also ties into directly a secret chief, which according William Westcott and according to Samuel Adel Mathers, this secret chief blessed them to start the third lodge of the Golden Dawn. And I'll explain why it was the third lodge and not the first lodge, even though it's actually the first lodge. We'll get into that in a second. So as William Westcott and Samuel Adel Mathers are deciphering this manuscript, they come across an address of an aged adept named Fräulein Anna Sprengel in Germany. And according to Westcott, he wrote to Sprengel inquiring about the manuscript. You know, what does this manuscript really mean? We need help with this. We're definitely deciphering some things here, but we really want to know more. So Sprengel gets back to him and accepts the request of Westcott and Mathers, and then issues them a charter to operate a lodge in the Order of England, which they name the Isis Urania Temple, style number 3. And if you know anything about lodges, specifically Freemasonic lodges, they'll have their lodge number engraved or in some manner put on the actual lodge on the outside. So a lot of secret societies would also do the same thing. And this is what the Golden Dawn did. So the reason why it was number 1, temple number 1, was supposedly Fräulein Sprengel's lodge. And then there was a number 2 that was a lodge that tried to be raised and it fell through some unnamed person who was supposedly connected to the SRIA, but it didn't work out. So number two was never actually a lodge that was functionable. But because William Westcott and Samuel Del Mathers said that it had been worked on, they were just told from Springle to start lodge number three. But that's the little bit of controversy behind why they called their lodge number three. Now, here's the best part. A lot of controversy around, was Springle even a real person? So their ideas about the sources of the cipher, right? The main one that a lot of historians say, they say that Westcott and Mathers actually created the manuscripts and the letters themselves. And they created the origin, the myth of the Rosicrucian Adepts, which would be secret chiefs, which would tie right into Springle. And they did that to give their new order validity. And I'm not going to throw that out. Again, you know how I do on this show. We'll never throw out the supposed obvious answer that's in front of you, right? Or what we would consider in the truther conspiratorial space as the mainstream answer, right? Just because it's mainstream doesn't mean that it's wrong. And I'm going to continue to beat this dead horse the entire length of this show forever and ever. As long as this show goes on, I will continue to say that because it is true. Well, we have to look at things legitimately at the base core. Just because it comes out of a mainstream outlet doesn't mean that's fake. Everything that comes out of mainstream is not fake, guys. You know, there can be some very real things come out of it. Doesn't mean they're not spewing out lies as well. I mean, everybody's got agendas, right? You know, I can spin to make what I want to look good, we'll do. But if the truth looks good, then hey, we'll talk the truth. Then there's another idea about possible sources of the cipher, AFA Woodford, which we talked about, that gave these letters to Westcott. He actually did, and he gave it to him to be decoded. And it's actually a real thing. Some people think that the letters were forgeries, but that Westcott and Samuel Del Mathers didn't know that they were forgeries. That's also a huge possibility. And then there are several other ideas floating around about who might have written them. Edward Bulwer Lytton is brought up, and we've talked about him plenty of times on this show, specifically in connection with the Vril. They said that he was an honorary patron of the SRIA, and they said that he was the writer of these said letters too. Maybe, who knows, right? It's hard to say, but I can say the story of Anna Springle is very interesting when it comes to the secret chief, because according to what they were able to decipher, they said was a Countess of Lansfeld and the love child of Ludwig I of Bavaria and Lola Montez. But they said that she's a person that they cannot find the existence of. And again, mainstream's going to tell you that Westcott and Samuel Del Mathers made her up to give their new order of the Golden Dawn the extra push it needed, give it the validity that it needed. William Wynne Westcott said plenty of times she entered into massive correspondence with him, said she was born in Nuremberg, and she helped create the Golden Dawn in 1886. And he said in secret that she held a Rosicrucian ritual and nominated him to be the head of the Golden Dawn in Britain. Now, again, he could have made all this up to then state that, oh, I'm the head of the Golden Dawn. Mathers and everyone else that they brought in, they would have had this reason to have started this order. But here's another interesting tidbit. And we know from Crowley that Samuel Del Mathers was in contact with secret chiefs, which he always attributed to being very supernatural. In 1892, Mathers claimed that he had contacted the chiefs independently of Springle, who was also a chief, and they confirmed his position as head of the Golden Dawn. So he declared this in a manifesto 4 years later, saying they were human and living on Earth, but they possessed terrible superhuman powers. So this is back to that ascended master, the human ascending, right? You've got a couple different kinds of secret chiefs here, right? You got the entities that are secret chiefs, and then you've got people who can ascend to become secret chiefs. And this all goes into Christ consciousness and the idea that Buddha, Krishna, all of these great prophets, Muhammad, they're all considered to be secret chiefs. Jesus would be considered to be a secret chief in this line of thinking. Now, to get a little bit deeper into the connection between the secret chiefs and the men in black, we're going to talk about how the secret chiefs have been talked about as being movers and shakers of governments, of major political events throughout the world. So this mythology of the secret masters or chiefs and this myth of the Great White Lodge, the Black Lodge, and this direct tie-in to magic and the occult sometimes throws people off that don't believe in these things, that will say, well, the secret chiefs, they're not a real thing. They're not anything that we need to be thinking about. These occultists are just mad. They believe something that wasn't true, or they tried to push something in a very deceptive manner to either siphon money off of people or control or whatever else. But one of the interesting things about the legends of the secret chiefs, a lot of them have their bases in high masters that are scattered throughout the world, that are actually connected to political leaders, that are actually connected to people who are integrated within governments. We can even look to Wolfram von Eschenbach, and he was a German knight, poet, and composer, and he was regarded as one of the greatest epic poets of medieval German literature. And one of the great works that he wrote was Parzival. And Parzival is a medieval chivalric romance, and it's about the Arthurian hero Parzival, or Percival in English, and his long quest for the Holy Grail following his initial failure to achieve it. So what's interesting that Eschenbach talks about, he talks about this Grail mythology, and he connects this idea of Parzival being in a very similar position to an ascended master or a secret chief, the idea that he has some sort of bloodline that can allow him to ascend, gives him the right to ascend. Again, this goes back to what we talked about in the last episode in the cloud upon the sanctuary, where it specifically talked about that you need to be one of the elect, one of the chosen to be able to receive the knowledges. And Wolfram talks and says, writing was seen on the Grail to the effect that any Templar, and we're back to the Templars, whom God should bestow on a distant people for the Lord must forbid them to ask his name or lineage, but must help them gain their rights. Members of the Grail Company are now forever averse to questioning. They do not wish to be asked about themselves. So he's basically saying that they've been given this right, this authority, to the point that they don't even ask questions anymore about what they're supposed to do. They just know why they're supposed to do it, and they do it. And that ties into Parzival. And part of this Grail quest in book 9, he has this weird problem within himself. He feels like he's alienated from God. He's been wandering and fighting for 5 years, and he's trying to find the Grail. And on Good Friday, he meets this holy man, Trevorcent, and he stays with him for 14 days. And this holy man gives him the hidden meaning of life and the true meaning of the Grail. Oh, here we go. And it was informed to him that his mother, Parzival's mother, is the sister of a fisher king, the Grail King. And at this point, he knows he has the bloodline. And this goes all the way back to my Bloodlines of Jesus series, because this entire quest, this entire story of Parzival is riddled with the hidden meaning of the bloodlines of Jesus. And you may wonder, well, why are we bringing this up as a part of the Men in Black? Well, it's important because of why some of these people who feel like they can ascend to become secret chiefs, why they feel like they can. And this is an example of one who believes that they are of this Grail bloodline, that they have the right, the authority to ascend, to become an ascended master, and to get a little bit deeper into bloodlines and creations of beings that could be considered secret chiefs or considered beings that could ascend to be secret chiefs, we got to look at Aleister Crowley. We got to look at the idea of the Moonchild, and that's very important. And we know that in the book Moonchild, which I've talked about on this show several times, it's a battle between the Great White Brotherhood and the Black Lodge, and it's all over this homunculus, this Moonchild that's trying to be created. During that same period of time, Crowley wrote Liber 811 called Energized Enthusiasm, and it's actually an essay and explores the connection between creativity, genius, and sexual energy within the framework of Thelema. And he suggests that there's this unique secretion similar to semen. It's linked to this creative inspiration. And oddly enough, and I wouldn't say oddly enough, considering it's Crowley talking about, but this secretion is invoked through sexual practices, through sexual magic. And it's the concept of theurgy, which you're invoking divine forces through rituals and practices. And he says that this secretion is vital for creative genius. And oddly, it kind of made me think of another guy called Eeyore Bach, who wrote the Bach Saga. And maybe one day I'll touch the Bach Saga. I don't know. I remember it got really hot a couple years ago and it died down pretty quick once people realized just how off the chain Eeyore Bach was and the stuff he was teaching. But he also used the form of auto fellatio, made me think of this secretion helps with gaining knowledge, gaining the ability to understand what others can't understand. And the reason why also it reminded me of Eeyore Bach, because he's literally consuming his own secretions. Well, part of this energized enthusiasm, this Liber 811, Crowley talks about the consumption of a mixture of semen and vaginal secretions. So again, this is all sex magic. I try to be as clinical as possible with the terminology, trying not to get too reckless, but at the same time, I got to convey the message to you guys. But that's what Crowley was doing. Now, what's interesting about this energized enthusiasm, because I know you're wondering, what does that crazy sex magic part have to do with the Men in Black? Well, in Energized Enthusiasm, he actually talks about meeting a person or entity that comes off very similar to what a man in black might do whenever you meet them. So Crowley starts with, "Thus far I had written when the distinguished poet whose conversation with me upon the mysteries had incited me to jot down these few rough notes knocked at my door. I told him that I was at work on the ideas suggested by him and that, well, I was rather stuck. He asked permission to glance at the MS, for he reads English fluently, though speaking but few words, and having done so, kindled and said, 'If you come with me now, I will finish your essay.' Glad enough of any excuse to stop working, the more plausible the better, I hastened to take down my coat and hat. 'By the way,' he remarked in the automobile, 'I take it that you do not mind giving me the word of the Rose Croix.' Surprised I exchanged the secrets of INRI with him. 'And now, very excellent and perfect prince,' he said, 'what follows is under this seal.' And he gave me the most solemn of all Masonic tokens. 'You are about,' said he, 'to compare your ideal with our real.'" So they're bringing him into this inner sanctum, this hidden sanctum. He's asking Crowley questions. He's talking about the Rose Croix. He's asking him to exchange secrets to make sure he's on the up and up, that he's in, that when they bring him into this place where they're going to do rituals, that Crowley is an actual adept. "He touched a bell, the automobile stopped, and we got out. He dismissed the chauffeur. 'Come,' he said, 'we have a brisk half mile.' We walked through thick woods to an old house where we were greeted in silence by a gentleman, though in court dress, was very practical sword. On satisfying him, we were passed through a corridor to an anteroom where another armed guardian awaited us. He, after further examination, proceeded to offer me a court dress, the insignia of a sovereign prince of Rose Croix, and a garter and mantle, the former of green silk and the latter of green velvet, lined with a cerise silk. 'It is a low mass,' whispered the guardian. In this ante room were three or four others, both ladies and gentlemen, busily robing. So they go to a third room. They found the procession there. And this is when they start going through a series of rituals and events. But going back to the initial meeting, this quote-unquote poet, according to Crowley, is a mysterious character that shows up that's going to help him write, I'll do this in air quotes, his manuscript. And this goes back to many times that Crowley has interacted with beings who have helped him to automatically write. And again, when you're reading Crowley's writings, you got to look at the layers. I've been talking about this from the get-go with Crowley. It's not just you're reading it at first glance and you're saying, oh, that's just a regular person that showed up at his house. No, you also have to look at what other occult adepts are saying about it. And when I'm looking and cross-referencing what they're saying, they are saying this is not a regular human being. This is someone who's showing up in a suit, who is bringing him to a place where they're going to perform rituals, but this person is of a supernatural nature. So this plays into this idea of the men in black being of, in many cases, not of this world. And to get a little further into what Aleister Crowley thought about these secret chiefs, we have to look at his confessions. And his confessions are this autobiography that was written. And I have pulled from the confessions many times, and I'll continue to pull from it, especially when I'm doing the Agent Crowley series, because I believe that in his diary and in the confessions that a lot of this is layered verbiage. And I also believe that he left a lot out, that he didn't want people knowing. In this confessions, he says, yes, this involves a theory of the powers of the secret chief so romantic and unreasonable that it seems hardly worth a smile of contempt. I propose to quote it here in order to show that the most ordinary events apparently disconnected are in fact only intelligible by postulating some such people as the secret chiefs. So it goes back to this idea that I brought up that as supernatural as these secret chiefs seem at times, there's also a very human level to a lot of them. And them being these political figures that are working behind the scenes with these occultists to push certain agendas, to move certain things. And we also have to look at it from that aspect too. And I'm not saying those human beings connected to magical practices and may have had some sort of supernatural abilities because of that, but we have to look at the real human element of these secret chiefs too. And I think that brings us into the men in black idea and why these men in black can seem very human when they come to people for various reasons. Not all UFO related, even though in more modern times, that's what we see. But yes, I think that there is a very human element, albeit sometimes they don't feel very human, but there's a very human element to them. So that was Crowley talking about how that even ordinary events are connected somehow to these secret chiefs. That as much as he wants to push away the idea of how supernatural the secret chiefs are and what they're involved in, he can't, because every time that he's working behind the scenes, and I will say to the point of him being a secret agent, working behind the scenes, that he will see these things play out in a way that others won't. And he said, well, I can't throw it out. And he, 20 years later, in Magic Without Tears, Liber ABA, he brings it up again. He says they, the secret chiefs, can induce a girl to embroider a tapestry or initiate a political movement to culminate in a world war. So he's saying the secret chiefs can do a multitude of things. And this goes back to the idea of them having a very supernatural element to them, a very angelic element to them. And we're going to get into that part too, about what these beings actually are at the root core and what these messengers are trying to give people. It's just like he said, they can cause a girl to embroider a tapestry. You know, what's the tapestry for? What's the purpose of it? That seems mundane, right? But then he goes as far to say, well, they can initiate a political movement to start a war. He also says, all in pursuit of some plan wholly beyond the purview or the comprehension of the deepest and subtlest thinkers. But are they men in the usual sense of the word? They may be incarnate or discarnate. It is a matter of their convenience. So he says that they can embody and present themselves in any manner that they want to. Now, this is lending way more into what I just suggested, the Malakim, the messenger, the angel, the shapeshifter that we know they can do from the Bible. And to get a little deeper into the secret chiefs having a more political element to them and what they're doing in that front, we got to look at Paul Johnson. And he did some great studies when it comes to theosophical matters. And we're speaking specifically of theosophy. And he goes deep when it comes to secret chiefs, hidden masters. He actually wrote a book called The Masters Revealed, Madame Blavatsky and the Myth of the Great White Lodge. Now, his angle when he wrote this book was that these secret chiefs exist, these ascended masters exist, but it's a myth. The myth was created to hide who the people really were and what they were really doing, because these people that were considered these secret chiefs were actually very major players in the political realm. And he gets deep into Madame Blavatsky and how that he believes, yeah, she was making these trips to Egypt, India, and she was meeting with these ascended masters, like she said, but those ascended masters were not the people she said they were. They were actually just names that were fronts for political leaders that we'll never know, which also lends into the idea that Helena Blavatsky was more than just an occultist, more than just someone who was pushing this idea of theosophy, that she also was connected in these political machinations. And this makes me think of John Dee. It makes me think of Aleister Crowley. It makes me think of Jack Parsons. It makes me think of all of these occultists that somehow they're connected secretly behind the scenes with all of these governments around the world. All of them. And I think this is a great way to look at these secret chiefs being the men in black. Men in black are verbatim connected to governments, verbatim connected to three-letter agencies, even if they're three letters that we've never heard of. Another guy that really went into this ideology was Jocelyn Godwin, and he is an historian of the occult and esotericism. And he's also a museologist and translator known for his work on ancient music, early music, paganism, and music in the occult. And he's also an original composer as well. But he wrote a series of articles about the hidden hand. Now, the hidden hand's interesting, and I'm sure you guys have heard of the hidden hand. And it's something that's talked about a lot in modern occult history. And it essentially represents the hidden cabal, right? The one that moves and shakes behind the scenes and moves governments. The occult world talks about it too. And Jocelyn specifically talks about the HB of L, which is the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor, which appeared in England. And he talks about them being a part of this hidden hand. And he actually notes, the order in question has always been known by its initials alone, which leaves it ambiguous whether the L stands for Luxor or light, though they may mean the same thing. So this plays into the idea of Lucifer, the light bringer, the light bearer. And this is what the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor stands for, which makes sense if we're talking about hidden hands throughout. And both of those guys, Jocelyn Godwin and Paul Johnson, talk specifically about these secret chiefs, these hidden masters, who, according to them, are just real people. And Johnson goes a little further when he starts talking about these secret chiefs, and he says that the secret chiefs of theosophy, the Golden Dawn, and the OTO may be able to initiate a political movement to culminate in a world war. And he's using Crowley's words there. And he also says, but to prevent one. But also, Paul Johnson goes further and says that some of these secret chiefs are actually given up as sacrifices, that they're not immune to arrest, torture, and execution, which would give it a more of an authentic feel, right? Because if these people never suffer any kind of death or persecution or any kind of scrutiny, then the people will revolt. But if they can play the game where certain ones are taking hits, certain ones are dying, then it throws people off into who's a secret chief, who is a part of a cabal, and it has people constantly guessing. And Johnson brings up Alessandro di Cagliostro specifically, and he was an Italian occultist, and he was a what they call a confidence trickster. And he was a self-styled magician, and he was in everything. Psychic healing, alchemy, scrying. He was also called a quack. And many people called him out and said that he wasn't for real. And at one point, he ends up leaving England to go to Rome. And he meets two people, and they ended up being spies of the Inquisition. And so we don't know exactly what got him to the point of where they captured him and where he was put to death by whom, because some people think that his wife turned him in. Also, he was trying to create a Masonic lodge in Rome in 1789, and they said that's why they got him, and they locked him up, and then they ended up killing him in 1795. But in Johnson's book, he goes a little further when it comes to Cagliostro, and he says they were all committed to an international effort to combat religious dogmatism, extend the range of democratic government, and direct public attention to the values of liberty, equality, and fraternity. And he goes further into talking about some of the people that end up taking on Cagliostro's work and Cagliostro's mission, and how that this was an entire theosophical push that they were trying to implement in different parts of the world, knowing that, hey, some of our guys might get caught. Some of these quote-unquote secret chiefs might get caught. They might get killed because, you know, there's a religious persecution. We're pushing a form of religion, and some people might not like it. So I do agree with that aspect of it, for sure. And that's just the idea of these secret chiefs being purely human, right? And I think there's an aspect to that, for sure. But many who encountered these hidden beings would speak of them as super beings in human form. And one of those guys, Henry Steele Olcott, who I've talked about several times, and he was an American military officer, journalist, lawyer, Freemason, and co-founder and first president of the Theosophical Society. And he talks specifically of when he met Coot Hume, the legendary KH. And I'm going to read an excerpt from when he did. He said, "I was sleeping in my tent the night of the 19th when I rushed back towards external consciousness on feeling a hand laid on me. The camp being on an open plain and beyond the protection of lower police, my first animal instinct was to protect myself. Do you not know me? Do you not remember me? It was the voice of Master Coot Hume. A swift revulsion of feeling came over me. I relaxed my hold on his arms, joined my palms in reverential salutation, and wanted to jump out of bed to show him respect, but his hand and voice stayed me. And after a few sentences had been exchanged, he took my left hand in his, gathered the fingers of his right hand in the palm, and stood quiet beside my cot, which I could see his divinely face by the light of the lamp. Presently, I could feel some soft substance forming in my hand, and the next minute the master laid his kind hand on my forehead, uttered a blessing, and left. I found myself holding in my left hand a folded paper and wrapped in a silken cloth. And the letter, it turned out, predicted the death of two enemies of the Theosophical Society, which actually came to pass. Now, they said, according to this, that the identity of Master KH, and this is mainstream people that are trying to say that these are not supernatural beings, that these are political people. They said it was Thakar Singh, an enlightened radical Sikh leader in contact with the worldwide network of radicals in the 19th century. So I find it interesting, and that's coming from Johnson, who thinks that this was this radical Sikh leader. Maybe Thakar Singh had supernatural powers due to some connection to entities. We have to look at that possibility too. This is clearly from Henry Steele Olcott, that he's talking to some sort of either human or being with supernatural powers. Now, to get to another interesting story with an occultist connection to a secret chief and their supernatural powers, we got to look at Samuel Del Mathers. And we know that he was one of the founders of the Golden Dawn. He says in his account, "I was found absolutely imperatively necessary that there should be some eminent member especially chosen to act as the link between the secret chiefs and the more external forms of the order." So he's basically saying that, well, I got to be that guy. I got to be the guy that's talking to the secret chiefs and able to trickle it down to everyone else. That's a big issue that Crowley had with Samuel Del Mathers, because Crowley was trying to achieve what he needed to achieve personally. Plus, if we're going to suggest these ideas that the secret chiefs are political figures? Well, of course Crowley wanted to know who he was talking to. He was a secret agent. He was there in those secret societies also to gather information and bring them back to British intelligence and whatever other intelligence agencies he was working for. So it makes sense that Mathers would try to trickle the information out the way that he wanted to. And again, I'm not outside of the realm that he wasn't talking to supernatural beings as well. Because again, it's this weird conglomeration of what the secret chiefs actually are. It's not one set thing. So Mathers goes on. He says, it was requisite that such a member should be me, who, while having the necessary and peculiar educational basis of critical and profound occult archaeological knowledge, should at the same time not only be ready and willing to devote himself in every sense to a blind and unreasoning obedience to these secret chiefs. And Regardi says, while walking in the Bois de Boulogne one day, meditating, Mathers claimed triumphantly that he was approached by what? Three men? Ho-ho-ho. This goes to that rule of three when it comes to the men in black as well. He asserted that these were adepts belonging to the hidden or secret third order, and therefore belonged to that category of men described in the cloud upon the sanctuary. Apparently, so he claims, they had materialized themselves and in that tense emotional and spiritual atmosphere of psychic phenomena confirmed him in the sole rulership of the order. Mathers observed that for his part, I believe they are human beings living on this earth, but possessed of terrible and superhuman powers, which I'd read before. So this was the initial meeting that Mathers had with these secret chiefs, these men, these three men who are showing up to give him a message. I'm not going to deter from the possibility that Mathers made it all up. He could have, just to assume power and say that, hey, I'm talking to the secret chiefs. You don't get to talk to them because you're not on my level here in the Golden Dawn. Hence why Crowley was always angry and ended up having a huge rivalry and couldn't stand Mathers in the end. It could very well be that he did meet these three men or three beings who materialized in front of him, which we've heard that men in black also do. They materialize. They actually will materialize in rooms. They'll walk through walls. And what's funny too, occultists love to mix these ideas of biblical stories and mix it in with the occult and say that, oh, this is actually what this person was talking to. You know, Moses was talking to a burning bush. No. See, he was talking to this being that wasn't the God you think it is, was something else. Or in more modern times, these are UFOs. These are aliens. And one of the stories that they specifically bring up is the story of Saul. And we're going to go to Acts 9. And I'm going to explain to you why I'm reading this and why it's important to shift into more of what these men in black are. So in Acts 9, verse 1, meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the disciples of the Lord. So he is not Paul yet. He's out here taking out Christians left and right. He approached the high priest and requested letters to the synagogues in Damascus so that if he found any men or women belonging to the way, he could bring them as prisoners to Jerusalem, anyone following the teachings of Jesus. As Saul drew near Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? Saul asked. I am Jesus whom you are persecuting, he replied. Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do. Men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the voice, but did not see anyone. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could not see a thing. So he led him by the hand into Damascus. For 3 days he was without sight, and he did not eat or drink anything. And this is when he meets Ananias, and then he ends up becoming the Apostle Paul. It's important to bring that up because of how other beings will represent themselves when they show up. They'll show up in very similar manners, and they'll do it on purpose because they're mimicking the way that Yahweh, the way that Jesus will represent themselves, specifically in Scripture, and they will try to muddle those lines. And I thought it was interesting to bring up the story of Paul because I find that story a lot when I'm reading occult literature. And they will talk about the Apostle Paul meeting this angelic being, which I don't think he met an angelic being. I think he met Jesus on that road. Hey, according to occultists, Jesus is what? An ascended master. He spoke to Paul. He came out of this interdimensional space, spoke to Paul, and then went back with the other ascended masters, this very Gnostic ideology. And to even connect these messengers even further to this Men in Black idea that these secret chiefs are also connected to these beings, these angelic beings, dare I say. We got to look at Brad Steiger. And I've talked about Brad Steiger specifically when it comes to Star Children, Indigo Children. He's a big part of that push. He was the one that came out with the term star people, and he was an American writer of fiction and nonfiction works on the paranormal, spirituality, UFOs, true crime, and biographies. And he believed Atlantis was a real place. He met these beings, but he says in 1988, space beings have placed themselves in the role of messengers of God, or that we, in our desperation for cosmic messiahs who can remove us from the foul situation we have made on this planet, hope that there are such messengers who can extricate us from the plight we have brought on ourselves. So this is exactly the very modern way of looking at what these beings are. And the Men in Black are tied all into this. They're known as messengers. Whether they're telling you not to do something or whether they're delivering information, they are operating just like angelic beings. Just like angelic beings in the Bible. Just like angelic beings that we would consider fallen angels that have dealt with mankind since the dawn of time. We can go to the book of Enoch with the Watchers, but this is constantly happening, but now it's moved into this space being idea. And if we're of alien origin ourselves, or have this quote unquote bloodline in us, we're a star child, star people. We're able to connect to them even easier. And speaking of connecting to them, right? I want to get a little bit more into the ciphers. And this is going to speak specifically to Alan Greenfield and the cipher of the UFO knots and what he was able to find out when it comes to these entities. Now, the one thing I'm going to give Greenfield a lot of credit for, because he talks a lot about entities being deceptive and not telling the truth. The ones that say they're good aren't really good. And I find it fascinating from a guy who is deeply entrenched into the occult. Even he's not drinking all the Kool-Aid from everything these entities are trying to tell us. And he brings up specifically some of these different beings and their connection to demonic entities. And to get to some of that, he speaks specifically to John A. Keel. And I've talked about Keel before. And he was an American journalist and influential ufologist who is known as the best-selling author of The Mothman Prophecies. And he says that Keel long ago noticed that UFO contact incidents seem to step out of time in the usual sense. And this will speak specifically to a very strange story in April of 1965. There was a piece of parchment found wrapped around a glass vial, and it was containing some silver sand. And this was the site of Arthur Bryant's encounter with Yamsky. And Ernest Arthur Bryant, and he was a resident of Scorton, Devonshire, England. And at 5:30 in the afternoon on April 24, 1965, he saw a flying saucer approach him. It stopped near to him and a door opened. Three beings appeared and beckoned to him. He approaches the saucer. Two of the three beings appear to be non-human, but the third seemed to be a youth in his teens. So he speaks to the youth and the youth says his name is Yamsky. He said he's actually from the planet Venus, and he gives him some information, and then he says, I'm going to come back in a month and I'll bring more proof. Well, that's crazy enough, right? But the really interesting part about this is that according to Bryant, that Yamsky was an ascended master himself, a newly ascended master. Well, this ties directly into George Adamski. Now, George Adamski was a Polish-American author who was widely known in ufology circles and also known in some popular culture. He's the one that came out and said he met with the Nordic aliens, the Space Brothers. I've talked about him before on this show, and some people think he was a charlatan or a hoaxer. But interesting enough, George Adamski died the day before Yamski shows up to Arthur Bryant. Now, Arthur Bryant is not some occultist, ufologist like that. He's just a dude. And he had a UFO show up on his property, and these beings come to him, and this Yamski, who looks very human. Well, it's funny. You've got George Adamski, who died a day before, and then here comes this youthful-looking human who says that, I'm the Ascension. I'm an ascended master. I'm a secret chief. Well, they immediately tied it into George Adamski. Now, we're talking about the piece of the parchment paper. It contained Greek words, Adelphus Adelpho, which means brother to brother. So that's important because 2 years later, in December of 1967, there was a student, Tom Matteleone, and he encountered a UFO being in Adelphi, Maryland. So it's interesting, these encoded words, these secret ciphers keep popping up that are showing where this being's going to show up in another place. And it's connected to these beings showing up in different places constantly. And that's what Greenfield is arguing in the book, that if you have the cipher, then you can discover what is going on with these UFOs, with these aliens, with these men in black. And you can start understanding why they're showing up and what they're actually connected to. And he also goes further because he's connecting this directly into angelic beings. And he's talking about how that modern cases of angelic visitation resemble visitations of the men in black. And the Hebrew word malakim for angel stands for messenger. And a lot of times those messengers tie into these ultra-terrestrial messengers. So these angelic names that we see that pop up throughout a lot of these different writings of these different cultists, they tie directly into the newer versions of these ultra-terrestrial or alien messengers that come. Ties back to what we just talked about, the Adamski to the Yamski. You're going to see that. We just talked about the parchment paper that directly correlated to another event 2 years later. So this is the cipher that we're talking about, figuring out the cipher. And not only do they show up in the Bible as far as angelic beings and messengers bringing information from God to us, but they also show up in demonology. And that's something that Greenfield really gets into, is how that some of these entities that are considered aliens now are directly connected to demonic entities that are in demonology. And one of those is Ashtar, and sometimes called Ashtar Sharon, and is the name given to an extraterrestrial being or group of beings that several people have been known to have had interaction with or have actually channeled. And one of those is George Van Tassel, and he's an American contactee, ufologist, and author. He was born in Jefferson, Ohio in 1910, and he grew up in a decently prosperous middle-class family. He acquired a private pilot license as he got older. When he was 20 years old, he moves to California, and he becomes an automobile mechanic. And while he's pumping gas at this garage where he's working for his uncle, he gets tight with this guy called Frank Kritzer, and this guy is an eccentric. And he's working on a mine near this place called Giant Rock. And it's a 7-story boulder near Lanners, California. What he ends up doing is living under this rock. They build these rooms under this rock. And out there, they start channeling. And he meets Ashtar, this alien. And Ashtar would be directly connected to the Nordics because he was very humanoid, blonde hair, European features. As a matter of fact, New Age religions now are connecting Ashtar and putting him alongside Jesus and Krishna. And again, saying he is an ascended master, saying he is a part of that pantheon of prophets and people who have ascended into this other realm. And when Van Tassel met with Ashtar was in 1952, because he said he was receiving telepathic communication from this being called Ashtar. And Ashtar is considered like the first superstar when it comes to alien beings during this big flying saucer age that was going on when the new age was mixing in with all of the UFOs that were popping up after the 1940s. And he, Van Tassel, shocker, interprets the Christian Bible in terms of extraterrestrial intervention in the evolution of the human race. And he claimed he was one of the big first ones that Jesus was a being from outer space. This is where you get all these crazy ideas that Jesus is an Arcturian and he is an alien and we can be just like him, which I think that we're supposed to live life like Christ, but not as a extraterrestrial being, if that makes any sense. So that's a little bit of the lore of Ashtar, but then Greenfield goes into the cipher part of this. And he talks about that as much as Ashtar has shown up in these ufology circles as this almost godlike extraterrestrial being, he says that in traditional occult circles, that Ashtar is a demon of considerable power. And he finds it funny that in UFO lore, he shows up as this positive force, as he's identified by the people who connect to him. And Ashtar tells people that which beings are etheric, which beings are good, which are astral, which are satanic. And he talks about Uranus, who he identifies with Satan himself. Well, this is when Greenfield really gets deep, when he starts tying in the cipher and numerology. And we'll get into that a little bit here. I don't touch on a lot of gematria and numerology on this channel unless it makes sense with the context of what I'm researching, but it does make sense here. So he finds that when he starts deciphering what these words are, what they mean, he finds that they end up being almost a revelation of what these beings actually are. So he breaks Ashtar down to 47, which equals Atlans, which also ties into Atlantans, and it also ties into Aeons. So you know they're trying to bring about the new Aeon. So this is Ashtar bringing in this new Aeon. Then we've got Uranus, we were just talking about, was said by Ashtar to be Satan. It yields 74, it equals solar disk. Well, that made me think, when I heard solar disk, I was like, wait a minute, that reminds me of something that Crowley's talked about, which ties into the Stele of Revealing. And this was the Stele that Crowley and his wife at the time, Rose Edith Kelly, had went into the Cairo Museum, and she walked him to imagery of Ra, and it was the Stele of Revealing, and it had the three beings that tie directly to the Book of the Law that Crowley wrote with the help of Iwas, Nuit being one of them. And Nuit is this solar disk that's in the Stele. So this is directly correlated to this Ashtar, which Crowley also says that the solar disk is tied into Satan. So it's very interesting that Ashtar, which is presenting himself as this being of light, this being of good to all these new agers, all these people now that are running around, Jesus is an Arcturian, he's an alien, we can be friends with the alien, we can do it. All these people have no clue about the occult ramifications of what these beings actually are. And we break this down all the way down to the solar disk to Satan, we realize more and more what these beings actually are. And Greenfield goes further and says that the occult literature has always considered Ashtar or Ashtaroth. Ding, 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 ding. How many times have I talked about Ashtaroth on the show, guys? Especially when I'm talking about what? Nephilim giants who come from the land of Ashtaroth Karnam that this principality ruled over, this fallen entity. But this is going to the occultists, guys. These are the guys who are in the mystery schools that understand what these words are, and they are baffled by these ufologists who are meeting these entities that said they're extraterrestrials, and they all have the names of fallen angels, demonic entities. The occultists know. They're sitting there telling you. And he says, the occult literature is always considered Ashtar or Ashtaroth a fallen angel that is a malevolent demon. He even says that the Lemageddon, which is the Lesser Key of Solomon, or some people call it the Book of Evil Spirits, says that Ashtar talks about the fall, the angelic fall, but he pretends that he himself was exempt from their laps. So he's saying, I wasn't really part of that, but I'm not allowed into heaven with the rest of them. And this is what Greenfield is saying, that suspiciously what Ashtar was doing with contactees, that he was basically saying that, I'm actually the good one. Let me show you who the bad ones are when they're all bad. And I'm not even saying they don't have infighting. I say that all the time on the show. I think there's definitely infighting. They're all on the same team. And even further, when it comes to Ashtar, he's connected directly to the what? Black man, the man in black in medieval demonology. So he could tie directly into the men in black as well. We also have to leave ourselves open to the idea that these entities are shape-shifting in a bunch of different things. So one being could play a ton of different parts. You might see it representing a man in black. You might see it representing a Pleiadian. You might see it representing the Arcturian Jesus Christ. Seriously, it's not all, they're just one thing. They're playing the part of a lot of different parts. So to get further into this angel idea of the men in black, and we're going to get really on some hardcore men in black type stories here with angel contact. So Time Magazine put this out in December of 1993, and it was a story called Angels Among Us. So in the summer of 1977, there was an Anne and Gary Kennedy, and they were visited at a time of extreme stress by a mysterious person. So Anne was diagnosed as having uterine cancer, and she was 3 days away from having surgery. And her husband, Gary's wife, had died of the same disease, which I think that's interesting too. And I think there is a correlation between diseases and demonic entities. And I don't want to go too far down that road because I don't want to say that everyone that's sick isn't right with God, or a demon gave it to you, or it's an attack from a demon. But I will say sometimes it can be, right? And it's interesting that Gary's first wife died of the same thing, and then his second wife gets the same thing, and then this weird scenario happens. So doorbell rings, it's 3 days before she's supposed to have this surgery, and standing on the step was a large man, a good inch taller than her 6'5" husband, so he's tall. She said he was the blackest black I have ever seen, and his eyes were a deep, deep blue. And he introduced himself as Thomas, and that was it. And he said her cancer was gone. So they invited the mysterious stranger inside, and he affirmed that she was healed. And he asked her point blank who she was. And he said, I am Thomas. I am sent by God. So then he lays hands on her, and she felt a burst of light and heat go through her body, and she passed out. And so then there was testing after that, and literally the cancer was gone. Now, you may say, what does that mean? What does that mean in the sense of healing? One of the things that I've theorized on is if a negative entity starts something, creates a sickness, creates something, then they could take it away, right? It's been started by them and they're able to take it away. It doesn't mean God can't take it away if that person finds God or anything like that either, right? There's so many different nuances to it. But it's just something that I've kicked around the past few years because I've found some interesting stories with people who are clearly not on a righteous path that have these weird scenarios that happen. But then I track before what was going on and who they were talking to. And, this person can cause the problem, then remove it. But then essentially, you don't even know you're getting a bigger problem on top of that because now you got more demonic entities around you and more things happening. So it could be something similar to this. I just find it fascinating how a lot of healing works, especially in these light worker circles. And just to give you a kind of insight on myself, I've been in some weird scenarios, and I talked about this on the spiritual warfare episode I did with Bo Kennedy from the Bump podcast, but there were light workers on this place, and they were basically sicking problems on people, whether it was physical or mental, whatever, and then they were coming around and offering to help. Are you okay? Well, I got something that can help for that. That happened to me. where I knew I felt massively oppressed, where I was just being almost stuck to the chair and I couldn't breathe. And obviously I started praying and it lifted. This person who I thought at the time was creating said problem came to me and said, "Hey, are you okay? You know, I've got some magic that I can do to help you." And I told her, "No, I'm good. I'm actually fine." And she seemed shocked by it. So it kind of let me know that my paranoia wasn't actually paranoia, that I was on the right track. And I'm going to give you one more story before we get out of here. And this comes from Time, another angelic account that they give. So there's a Melissa Deal Fourth, and she was with her dying husband, Chris Deal, and she was comforting him. And to her, it seemed like she was communicating to him this sense of peace because he seemed to be coming at peace with the fact that he was dying. Well, later, he was discovered missing from the hospital bed only days before he was supposed to die, right? It was coming close. And she found him in a hospital chapel with a man she had never seen. He was tall. She said he dressed kind of like Chris did. He had a flannel shirt, new Levi's, laced up boots, but they looked like they'd been taken right off the shelf. Very similar to what we hear about the Men in Black. They have brand new suits every time. They don't look like they've ever been worn. Other similar stories with what we would consider someone looking like they're wearing a skin suit would have some sort of clothing. It looks brand new right off the shelf. This is a constant theme when we're looking at ufology stories about people meeting with beings that are trying to represent humans. And this is what this person looked like. She said there was no real age to him, no wrinkles, just this perfectly smooth, pale white skin and icy blue eyes. And she said, "I've never seen that color blue on any human before." And again, I don't know if this, in this particular case, if this entity was bad or if it was good, because I'm not saying that angels can't come either. But I do have a lot of trepidation when I hear what people do after they meet these angelic beings. Are they following a Christ-like path? If they're going down a specifically a cult or New Age route, got a hard time believing that these entities are actually good. And I think this ropes everything back around that we've been looking at for four episodes into what do I really think these Men in Black are? And I believe that there is a very supernatural element to some of them for sure. And I think that we can look to these fallen entities, these fallen angels that can shapeshift. And they would be something that we could pinpoint down as saying, "Hey, this is a good idea of what these Men in Black are. These Men in Black from the Black Lodge that are here to give us a message, whatever it is, you know, whether it's good, bad." And I think if they're giving us something good, it's probably bad anyway. And I think that as we've looked at this through the lenses of these people who are adepts in the occult world and what they think that these Men in Black are and these secret chiefs are, that they believe that they are some form of an entity. You know, some of them think they are humans with supernatural powers. Maybe so. I would say in conjunction with some sort of ritualistic magic and entities, those secret chiefs that they're connected to have brought them in this inner circle and called them secret chiefs too. At the root core, when I look at these Men in Black who just don't seem quite real, I lend more to the idea that they are some sort of angelic being on the fallen side that are doing what angels do, give messages. I'm doing a lot more than that too, especially when it comes to harming people. But I think that when we're looking at this particular type of Men in Black, and I'm not talking about like the real humans who have black suits on, who work for governments, who show up, that seem very real and very human, because I think those exist too. But we're talking about this particular type of Men in Black, the one that most people talk about, the one that doesn't seem quite right. That's where I go to when it comes to those. I would say fallen angels, maybe even if we want to go the route of the container, the moon child that hosts some sort of Nephilim spirit, we can go that route too. I think that would be right in line with the fallen angel aspect of it. But I think that's what we're more or less looking at. And again, I'm looking at what these occultists are saying. I find it funny that they find it laughable that people think that these are extraterrestrial beings when they always use the term ultra-terrestrial. Guys, I hope you had a blast in this four-part series. I didn't even know, really, when I started the research on it, it was going to end up being this many parts. And that's kind of how it happens with a lot of the shows that I do. I love putting out as much of the research that I gather out. And if it takes four parts to do it, then it takes four parts. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Guys, if you can, before you get out of here, go give me a five-star review on Spotify. Go give me a five-star review on Apple. If you're on Apple, please go write a review too. All that stuff helps the show get deeper in the algorithm so more people can see it. And at that point, share the show. Share it to anybody that you can so they can become one of the free-range rabbits as well. Also, we've got a brand new merch store, freetherabbits.myshopify.com. We've got all kinds of merchandise there. We're building the store as we go. We're going to have more than just shirts and hats. There's going to be a lot of other things there too. Keep on the lookout for that. On the way out, we're going to play my new song, Imposter. And you know what it is, guys. Go outside, touch grass, and get your tail out the hole.
I'm in a fun house, locked in a boxcar with all of these clowns. Don't feel like I belong, but maybe I do. Cause when I look in the puddle, maybe I'm just a ruse. Or maybe I'm just confused. Ooh, I'm a gorilla in the jungle, but my mind's got me trapped in the zoo. Pyramids of deception above the halls of Amenti. If I leave, will I even miss me? Yeah. Face to face with my ambition, yeah. My position with me, I'm in competition, yeah. I could be superstitious, cause it feels like it's a sickness. What you see is not what I see.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
download the Moto Casino app today